Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
What happens when we die? Or when we almost die? Hear from a neurosurgeon who had a near-death experience about his journey into the afterlife.
For those, you know, materialists who think, oh, when you die, your brain goes out, and then, of course, your consciousness goes to zero. Huh, get ready for a surprise.
And meet a woman who had a shared death experience. What it was like feeling her mother's struggle as she was dying thousands of miles away.
I'm just really lucky. I think I'm really lucky. I got exposed to something that was so transformative for me. You know, because if you don't believe in it and then it happens to you, I can't deny it. You know, I can't deny it anymore.
I'm Kyone Wolfe. That's next on Audacious, right after the news. From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, this is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolfe. You've heard of near-death experiences, right? You know, seeing the light, going through a tunnel, maybe seeing a beloved family member waiting for you, feeling a sensation of love, of peace, of relief. And maybe you've heard of shared death experiences where one person is actively dying and another person, maybe even hundreds or thousands of miles away, feels it, knows it. Turns out stories of near and shared death experiences have been told for thousands of years. It doesn't matter the age, the part of the world, religion, or non-religiosity of the person. These experiences, whatever they are, leave us grappling with reality unlike any other. Now, I know some people hear these stories and think, nope, no way, not buying it. These people are lying or hallucinating or some weirdness is happening with their brains. I don't know. And by the way, lady, why are you devoting a whole radio show to this? I pay your salary. Well, the reason I'm doing this show is I don't know what to make of this stuff. When I was young, I believed in God, and then in my 20s, I became a full-on capital A atheist. But now, in my 40s, after experiencing a lot of stuff that frankly defies any worldly explanation, I gotta say, I'm insecurely settled into the I don't freaking know place. And that place is full of possibilities. And I like possibilities. So in honor of how the very act of seeking answers can bring you to life, everlasting maybe, today we're hearing two stories. One about a shared death experience and one about a near-death experience, or an NDE. You may have heard Dr. Eben Alexander's name. He's kind of a big deal in the NDE world. He wrote Proof of Heaven, a neurosurgeon's journey into the afterlife, about his near-death experience in 2008 while in a coma due to bacterial meningitis. Now, don't be thrown off by the heaven thing. I know that's a loaded word. And frankly, what he says he saw doesn't sound anything like what I read in my Sunday school Bible. So I asked him, what did he see?
My journey, as I describe in detail in the book Proof of Heaven, began in a course of Earthworm's Eye View. I had no memory of my life. I had no words or language. None of my memories of Earth or this universe were there. It was an empty slate. And I think that was very important for some of the deepest lessons I was to learn. I was basically conveyed from that very primitive course, subterranean early stage, the Earthworm Eye View, through a brilliant portal of light and music up into the Gateway Valley. Gateway Valley had many Earth-like features. It was much more real than this world. That's the shocking thing. People don't expect that, that this reality is murky and dreamlike. That reality is wow. Oh, my God. And, you know, there were lots of other beings there. There was this incredible landscape of a verdant valley, that was lush with life, no signs of any death or decay. I was accompanied by a beautiful young woman on a butterfly wing. There were millions of other butterflies. There was tremendous festivities going on below. And in my early writings after the event, I called them souls between lives. And that is the most extraordinary aspect of the journey. Many lessons were taught there, and yet that was not my final destination, because just as music had provided the portal that took me up from that Gateway Valley, I mean, from the earth from my view to the Gateway Valley, likewise, all the festivities and joy and mirth I saw in this gateway were being fueled because up above were these swooping orbs of angelic choirs that were emanating chants and anthems and hymns that would just thunder through my awareness, this extraordinary richness. And they provided another portal. And I saw how time flow in this realm is very much a fiction. It supports the stage setting of the drama. Whereas in those realms, for example, more than half of near-death experiencers talk about a life review, where the main events of their life are relived in a very profound fashion. And that serves as lessons to us. But the reliving is not from their perspective. Interestingly, it's often from the emotional perspective of those around them who were affected by their thoughts and actions.
Did you ever see the TV show The Good Place?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I loved it.
So you know about Doug Forsett, who apparently during the character Doug Forsett, who during a magic mushroom trip, you know, described the nature of the afterlife to a surprising degree of accuracy, getting it 92% correct. Are there any religions or concepts or theories that you think, considering what you've experienced, have gotten close to getting it right?
Well, I think that in the deep meditative traditions of all the great faiths, where we just pay attention to the message of the prophets and do not subscribe to the scriptural and kind of dogmatic overlay, because that's where all the conflict and confusion comes in. But if we just focus on the deep prayer and meditative traditions, they all focus on oneness, kindness, compassion, that we're all in this together. And that is, I think, the most extraordinary lesson. And also the hardships, the apparent evil and darkness is there to serve as a gradient. You know, you can't have pure love and good isolated. It needs to be kind of in this juxtaposition, because we live in a world of dualities, of kind of wrestling opposites. And that's how Soul School works. But when you've been to that realm, the core realm was my ultimate destination. That's where all of this led, because the Gateway Valley was only a gateway. And in that core realm, oneness with God and oneness with all that is, shared purpose and meaning are the nature of the beast. It was something I call, a dazzling darkness. It's where all the paradoxes are resolved. But the problem is our language is built in this dualistic realm of paradox. So our language does not do a good job of explaining the depth of truth of this unification and synthesis through the binding force of love that has become so apparent to near-death experiencers going back thousands of years. And the themes are always about this love and oneness, and that's what we need to recover.
When you talk about Soul School, I like that. It feels like, when I think about what the hell we're all doing here, Soul School feels good to me. Do you know what's the objective of Soul School? Like, is there a graduation? Is there an end?
Well, it turns out that we can have a tremendous kind of illumination about all this through meditation and prayer and NDEs and shared death experiences, which are just like NDEs, but happen in healthy, normal people. And I believe all of it, in this world, we can only kind of see the horizon of where it leads us. And that horizon, I believe, is the kind of goal of lessons for humankind over the last many thousands of years, is towards this oneness, this notion of being sharing the one mind and being bound together through love and caring for each other. And beyond that, I'm not sure where it all leads, but I would say the goal humankind has been challenged with for the last 5,000 years plus is this one of learning the oneness and connectedness. And of course, it's not just about humans. This is about discovering the spiritual coexistence of all life. And animals are in this too. So you cannot pretend that they are not part of this process. In fact, I often think that animals in many ways have a spiritual richness that, for example, reincarnation is proven beyond any doubt in scientific studies of past life memories in children. Go to uvadops.org. They've discovered more than 2,500 cases of past life memories in children suggestive of reincarnation. You have to build that into the bigger picture to understand where this is all going. Anybody who hopes to have anything meaningful to say about consciousness in this day and era must accommodate reincarnation and this much broader view of non-local consciousness. There's no going back. The evidence all leads in one direction. And it's very good news for humanity because it's very unifying and it brings us together in this great synthesis of understanding.
You have said by 2028, no self-respecting, scientifically minded, well-read person on earth will doubt the reality of the afterlife and reincarnation based on scientific evidence. So why 2028 and what needs to happen on a grand scheme, do you think, for this to happen?
Well, 2028 was kind of arbitrary. It's because in the year 2018, I started publicly saying in all my presentations that, look, if you study the evidence, there's really no other conclusion. Consciousness is fundamental in the universe. We've never known anything other than the inside of our own consciousness. And even though our brain and mind are very good at fooling us into believing that we're witnessing the world out there, never forget, what you're actually witnessing is a model within mind that seems to have a lot of fidelity to some world out there, but there are plenty of psychological experiments and the results of quantum physics itself that tell us, no, there is a top-down causal principle of all emerging events. The mistake that some in materialist science make, and there's a beautiful quote from Werner Heisenberg, who won the Nobel Prize in 1932 for his work in quantum physics. He said, the first sip from the glass of natural sciences will lead you towards atheism, but at the bottom of the glass, God is waiting for you. And he knew exactly where this was headed, as did many other of the founding fathers of the field. Ultimately, all of reality is determined by top-down causal principles from the mental layer of the universe. That's the layer you get to in an NDE. That mental layer is that assimilative layer. It's probably better called a spiritual layer because ultimately all of the mental layers converge into that spiritual notion of oneness and God force. But the more you understand about modern quantum physics, the more you get where this is going. And the reason it's so important is because we keep thinking all that out there is physical reality. But in fact, what we're witnessing is nothing more than consciousness using the incredible quantum complexity of our brain to kind of project a brain, body, physical reality from the mental layer in this top-down causal fashion. And so it's never been more than those perceptions. I love how John Wheeler, one of the most renowned quantum physicists in the 20th century, he was the head of physics at Princeton University. He came up with this notion of the participatory anthropic principle. And what he was pointing out there is that nothing exists until it is observed by a sentient being. And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where this gets really astonishing. He was onto something. And in fact, when he made that statement, he compared himself to a theologian, an Irish theologian who had lived 200 years earlier, George Berkeley, who had said, to be is to be perceived. And Wheeler was basically admitting that quantum physics drives you inexorably to a realization that mind is what governs this universe. That's why, for example, the reality in our lives is mind over matter, placebo effect through the power of belief, of knowing. And this is why meditation and centering prayer can be so helpful in recovering health in every way imaginable.
I'm with you on that. I just recently started learning about meditation myself, and it's been remarkable. Can I ask about other planets? Follow me here. I have an idea. If we don't go poof into non-existence, I think it makes sense for there to be reincarnation, not just on planet Earth, but on other planets, other realms, other who the hell knows, because it's a big universe and we probably don't even know the 1,000th of it. What do you think about that? Do you think that Earth is the only place we come back to learn?
Not at all. In fact, I mentioned that in Proof of Heaven. I had a bigger description in the original manuscript. It got trimmed down by the editors to make this a palatable book to the general public. But I do, still there's text in there that refers to these vast civilizations that I witnessed. In fact, some of them as far above us as we are beyond earthworms. And of course, they have long, long, long ago completely escaped the shackles of the apparent time and space limitations that we think as material beings in a very, very primitive understanding of the universe. We feel limited by time and space. And yet there are what I saw as billions of civilizations, and many were far advanced beyond us. I think that in general, the patterns of information, you know, there's an old saying from Plotinus, the philosopher of ancient times, who said, like attracts like. And in many ways, you know, people often talk about vibration and resonance. And in many ways, that's part of the package. And so our soul, our kind of inherent being, has a certain resonance that will resonate with other aspects of this grander consciousness. And some of us have the ability to resonate, you know, with much more kind of different levels than what we encounter as humans on Earth, but others are a little more limited. But this is why I find meditation and opening the mind to be so very powerful. Once you realize that the mental layer of the universe is kind of universal and it's completely outside of time and space. So the entire Big Bang of the physical universe occurred within consciousness. And this is something that really kind of opens the door to tremendous possibilities. And that's where I think exploration of consciousness can be so important, because it shows us many, many possibilities. And especially in this era where when we're discovering, you know, in neuroscience and philosophy of mind, in quantum physics, this primacy of consciousness. And you look at the brain as a filter. So the brain, as we discuss in Living in a Mindful Universe, the brain is not even the storage place for memories. You know, that's really the last nail in the coffin of materialist neuroscience. If memories are not stored in the brain, then what's going on here? But it is completely a construct within mind. And it is, you know, the quantum physics, the reason it's mystified so many for so long is they kept expecting that consciousness was generated by physical matter, by the ion channels and synaptic clefts in the brain. Well, yeah, they play a role, but they're not Newtonian billiards. And it's not a causality in the way we normally think of it. There's a far more profound top-down causality. Our entire existence is something that's purely mental. And the more we explore that and come to play with it and enjoy it and embrace it, the more we realize we're far grander beings than just something that lives in this physical body and only exists birth to death. We've been here before. We'll be here again. We're all part of that one great mind. There's a great book for your listeners I would also recommend by Dr. Larry Dossey. It's called One Mind. It's a very profound kind of explication of the oneness of mind shared with animals, shared across humanity, much bigger than we normally think. And that's where the modern science is headed, because all the evidence points in this direction.
That's Dr. Eben Alexander, author of Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Find him at ebenalexander.com. When we get back.
No longer is the ego and the me only me the way the world works. It's all about the higher good and being here to serve and help others.
More of my conversation with Dr. Alexander. Plus,
I didn't know whether I was going crazy or having some kind of hallucination. I just, after I got over the shock of it, I felt calmed by it.
Meet a woman who experienced symptoms her dying mother was having from thousands of miles away. I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay with me. This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. Today we're talking about shared death experiences and near-death experiences. When we left off with Dr. Eben Alexander, author of Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, we were talking about his near-death experience. It happened in 2008 while he was in a coma due to bacterial meningitis, and it became clear, hearing his story about oneness with the universe and his visions of a beautiful, peaceful place over yonder, that he no longer fears dying. So I asked him, when he thinks about his own death now, what does he think?
I'm not in a hurry because I feel like I've got other things to do. But, you know, there's absolutely nothing to fear about. It's actually liberation from the prison, from the shackles. And for those, you know, materialists who think, oh, when you die, your brain goes out. And then, of course, your consciousness goes to zero. Huh, get ready for a surprise. When you die, you are freed up from the shackles of the physical brain. And I'll tell you, there's a very good example in modern scientific study that makes that case beautifully. And that is the study of the influence of certain serotonin 2A psychedelic drugs, psilocybin, magic mushrooms, LSD, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is the active principle in ayahuasca. There have been papers of studies done that the first publication I knew of was in 2012, Robin Carhart-Harris and colleagues at Imperial College London. They used psilocybin. And when they used functional MRI and magnetoencephalography, which are very powerful techniques to look at the cells in the brain and their neural activity, people under the influence of those substances, do not call them hallucinogens because these are not hallucinations. These are visions of a bigger reality. And what happens to their brain? The brain goes dark. There is no part of the brain that increases in activity under the influence of those substances. That has been borne out in paper after paper. People are shocked. Materialist neuroscientists struggle. What in the world? How do we explain this? In fact, Christoph Koch wrote an article in Scientific American. He's the head of the Paul Allen Neuroscience Research Center in Seattle. And in his article, in responding to that first Carhart-Harris paper about psilocybin, said, shock of all shocks, your brain under the influence of these substances goes dark. And it's because the brain is not creating the experience. The experience comes from a much deeper level of this, this one mind, this pure consciousness. And that's where it starts becoming very interesting because, you know, materialist science is at a complete dead end when it comes to explaining such phenomena. That's why many materialist neuroscientists say there's no such thing as consciousness. It's a complete illusion. They're ignoring the fact that the only thing they've ever known is the inside of their own consciousness. It's like asking a fish what it's like to be in the water. What water? Well, guess what, people? We are, you know, ultimately this consciousness is it. It's the only thing that exists. And that's good news because it opens tremendous power to us as we start to understand how we can glean information from that level of primordial mind. And not only that, how we can put it to use in our best interest for our highest and best outcome for all involved. And that's the important thing is no longer is the ego and the me, only me, the way the world works. It's all about the higher good and being here to serve and help others. And that's where NDEers will tell you, you know, as they have for thousands of years, that we're all in this together and we're connected through that binding force of love. And this is a lesson that our horribly polarized and kind of egocentric, me-focused and diseased world needs to hear. This kind of awakening helps all of us make more progress, and all of humanity can do that through this awakening.
Well, for those listening who are like, okay, this sounds reassuring. This sounds like, you know, if I've feared death, maybe it's like what Ram Dass said, you know, death is like taking off a tight shoe. It's a liberation. It's a freedom.
That's exactly right.
What do you think are some takeaways for people who may never experience a near-death experience, who will experience just a death experience, not just a, but a death experience? Is your message basically like, fear not?
Fear not. And not only that, but the greatest gift of near-death experiences and similar to spiritually transformative experiences and their scientific study is not, oh, comfort around what happens when I die, because I know it's not oblivion. But it's actually a deep and profound litmus test, an indicator of how we should act and view ourselves and our relationships with others. Every choice we make, every moment, every breath of this life in this world, that's where NDEs are so important. I came back from my own journey realizing that some of the world's greatest problems don't come because we don't love our neighbor or our enemy enough. It's because we don't love ourselves enough as the true, sacred, divine agents of love that we are. And the more we love to the world and share that love, that deep lesson of NDEs and all of our expressions in actions with others around us, the more it comes back to us in this beautiful, loving fashion, because we're basically resonating with our soul journey. We're maximally kind of transforming in this material lifetime based on our spiritual journey that is far, far bigger than, you know, any kind of human lifetime or anything in the physical world. So that's where the real power of NDEs comes through and is helping guide us in how to live these lives and how to view ourselves. It's just a real gift of the deep meditative traditions of the great faiths going back thousands of years that they came to the same answer, oneness of love. And now the science of consciousness is proving the same thing beyond any doubt. Once you study NDEs, study the reincarnation literature, study the healing literature, the power of mind over matter, go to uvadops.org to learn a whole lot more about one of the biggest scientific groups on earth, the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, where for six decades plus, they've been studying reincarnation memories, near-death experiences, all manner of non-local consciousness, that is parapsychological phenomena like telepathy, psychokinesis, distance healing, the power of prayer, precognition, the ability to know the future, presentiment, where you can prove that our autonomic nervous system knows the future. The evidence is already all around us. And that's why this world needs to wake up now.
Well, Dr. Evan Alexander, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. And you covered a lot of territory. Very good job.
Related to near-death experiences are shared death experiences. That's when, say, your mother in Oregon begins actively dying and you, a therapist in England, start choking. That's what happened to Annie Capp of Canterbury, England. She's the author of Beyond Goodbye, an extraordinary story of a shared death experience. I asked her to describe what happened that day.
I started gagging. I felt like I was being strangled and suffocating. And for some reason, I had this gurgling sound. And the gurgling sound, as it ended up being my mother was dying in her fluids of her lungs. And I was having this very strange thing happen for about 20-25 minutes. And I was working with a client. I was doing counseling at that time in my life. And I had to ask him to leave as soon as I kind of twigged what was happening. I realized as I tried to clear out this congestion, whatever it was, I was downstairs in my downstairs bathroom and I was coughing up like a cat coughs up a hairball. And I was trying really hard to clear it, thinking, you know, I've got to go back to work. I got to help this guy. I've got to get back. And then as soon as I realized I couldn't clear it and I work upstairs normally, started climbing my staircase. I just had this overwhelming, terrible feeling that it was my mom. So at the time of the choking, I didn't know that it was my mother, but then I realized I was climbing. I had to get rid of this guy. I felt really bad because it's like, you must leave. My mother's been in hospital and I'm concerned for her. I need to call her. And I got rid of him and it was a long ordeal, but because I live in the countryside and we had sheep in the field, I had to open up the gates for him and do all this stuff. And I'm running back to the house as fast as I can thinking, I hope she hangs on, you know, because we knew she was not long for the world and was going to be passing, but we didn't know when. So I called her up. I called the hospital and my sister answered the phone and she was by her side and told me that the nurses had just said that this was the last few minutes of her life. And they had called all my brothers and sisters, but not me because my sister didn't have international dialing. So my mom reached out for me.
This is 2004?
Yeah, 2004, January 2nd. Basically, my sister put the phone to her head and I said, you know, it's okay. You can go. We can let you go. And, or, you know, you can go. We'll be okay. And I love you. And I said goodbye. And then she died right then. Took her last breath as I said goodbye. So, yeah. Yeah. So it was very, I don't know. I think about it every day. it's just, it's always with me. And yeah, I'll probably start crying. Sorry. I haven't talked about this in so long. So it's nice of you to interview me.
I'm so glad to, and you're welcome to cry. It's good for you, I think, but,
yeah, definitely.
After it happened, what sense, excuse me. Now I'm clearing my throat. I'm like, Mom! No.
Hairball.
Yeah, just in the context of this interview. Maybe I'll call my mom afterwards. After it happened, I know that you, at the time, you didn't really believe in God and you didn't have much mm-hmm. spirituality. You didn't have a lot of faith in an afterlife. And
yeah.
I'd like to hear about what started changing in you. And then what started happening after your mom died that continued changing you?
Well, I couldn't ignore what took place. So first off, it was just the enormity of the experience. At the moment, you know, I was angry. I hadn't got a ticket and couldn't fly out there. I was grieving in a way I've never expected. I was sobbing constantly and I couldn't sleep. And when I did find, you know, I'd be crying when I did fall asleep, then I'd wake up crying. And I didn't think you could cry in your sleep, but you do. And I just was devastated by the loss of this woman who I find, my mom is amazing. What was, is amazing. And, so I had just huge loss. And then what happened was, is I started feeling her presence around me. So that's really what kind of took place. At the time, I had no idea of shared death experiences. I hadn't heard of empathic deaths. I didn't know what it was. You know, I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in guardian angels. I didn't believe in afterlife. You know, I kind of hoped there wasn't a hell, but I didn't know. Yeah. And so my husband over here in England and in Europe, they give you compassionate leave. So my husband had like 4 or 5 days off to help me through the grief. And he worked in Germany and I lived over here. He had to go back to work after 4 or 5 days. So he had to fly to Germany and I was doing my normal thing Monday through Friday alone and seeing him on Saturday morning, and he'd fly off at 4 a.m. on Monday morning. So as soon as he left, the most, I think, horrific thing happened. And it's in now it's really a special thing, but at the time I was so terrified. I was in my bedroom and I started crying in my sleep or half asleep. And I felt a very firm hand on my head stroking me. And of course I like went out punching and I thought that somebody had come into the house and that I was going to get attacked. So I had what they call an after death communication from her, basically. And I didn't know these terms, but I did end up researching it some 7 years later when I just couldn't stop thinking about her all the time. So it happened repeatedly. So as soon as I'd fall back to sleep and start crying, this thing would touch me again, right? So I'd feel this hand. And after like 3 or 4 days, I came to realize it was my mom. You know, I mean, I knew I wasn't going to be attacked, and it started to comfort me. So until he came back from his week away, she was stroking my hair like she did when I was a small child. So she always did that when I would be upset. She would put me in her lap, put my head down, and stroke my head. And so she was doing it. And I didn't know whether I was going crazy or having some kind of hallucination. I just felt really, really, after I got over the shock of it, I felt calmed by it. So that sort of stuff started happening. And I wasn't sure, do I tell my husband or does he kind of think I'm crazy? So I told him, he's my best friend. So I told him everything. And so then other things started happening. So when he was around to witness it so that I couldn't deny it, basically, she started leaving bobby pins around the house, and she had very dark hair and I have very blonde hair. So these bobby pins showed up, first showed up exactly where I was seated when I had the gagging experience. And then one showed up, my mom liked coffee as well as cigarettes, but one showed up by the coffee maker in the morning. And my husband and I went to bed together, get up in the morning, and there's the damn bobby pin sitting by the coffee maker. So it's like he found it and I found it. And I said, you know, what's going on? It's not like he was having an affair and some woman was in the house because we were together, right? So,
and you're in the countryside, so you'd see her coming.
Yeah, I would. So it's just stuff like that started happening. And it just, it went on from there. It just got, it got more surreal and more spiritual. And I started feeling like I was hearing people speaking to me. And so I actually really considered, you know, some, if something was wrong with me.
Right. Like psychologically.
Yeah. Like, do I need antidepressants? Is it electrolytes? Is something going on? And then my husband said, no, there's nothing wrong with you. These things are happening. We'd wake up with the room smelling like her smoke and just all sorts of stuff. So it got pretty intense for a while where it felt like somebody had opened up the door to all the ghosts, you know?
Yeah. Like a portal suddenly opened.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's kind of, it sounds funny, but if you've ever watched Ricky Gervais in Ghost Town, it was a bit like that. Because it wasn't then, my mother wasn't the only person coming to talk to me. So it was like very strange. So I ended up getting involved in a spiritual development circle where you learn how to meditate and do all this stuff. So I could figure out what was, what people thought was happening. And then I started researching and I found out this is a really normal, common after effect to a near-death experience.
So you check a few boxes that near-death experiencers check.
I checked of a questionnaire by one of the leading near-death experience researchers. I checked 21 out of 24 as if I'd had a, as if I'd died. So all that stuff that you think doesn't happen, it happens to people who've tipped their toe into the other after, the other side, you know, the afterlife. And I didn't, I never saw the white, you know, I didn't see the, you know, tube you might go up to or the white light or anything. But apparently when she connected to me and linked with me, the experts say that I somehow was brought over into that other dimension along with her, just even for those 20 minutes or those couple seconds when she died on the phone. I don't know exactly when I was tipping over, because they say that when people are dying, their consciousness is no longer inhabited in the body, so that it becomes loose and disconnected from the body and it can travel where they think.
So do you think that if you hadn't had been thousands of miles away, if you had been in the room like your sister was, she wouldn't have needed to do this, and then you wouldn't have had this, and therefore you and I wouldn't be talking?
Possibly. Or maybe I would have saw something, because they say that people, I was interviewed by a number of people myself. There's a lady named Penny Satori, Dr. Penny Satori. She was a like an ICU emergency, you know, a nurse in the intensive care unit. And she was with a lot of people who died. And she's got her doctorate because she did research into all these experiences. And then she researched other people's experience sitting by a dying person. And they say that it usually has to do with your connectivity with that person. So the fact that my mom and I were, we were like girlfriends versus mother, daughter in our, you know, years. And so, you know, we really cared about each other. And so it may have happened to me, but differently. Maybe apparently if you're sitting with the person and you have a bond with them strongly, you might actually see the light and you might see their body rise out of themselves. I think I would have had something happen with her, knowing what I know now. I think it's about the connectivity of the individuals, not just the proximity.
So do you think, assuming that your siblings did not experience what you did, are they kind of feeling left out?
Some of them, yeah. But one of my brothers was in the room when she died. I didn't know he was there until the day later when I spoke on the phone, that he was sitting there when I was speaking to her on the phone. He actually saw something, and he won't share it, but he said it was beautiful. And that, you know, that's pretty amazing. So he saw something lovely.
That was Annie Kapp. She's the author of Beyond Goodbye, an extraordinary story of a shared death experience. After the break.
I'm just really lucky. I think I'm really lucky. I got exposed to something that was so transformative for me.
I'm Kyone Wolfe. This is Audacious. Be right back. This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolfe. We spent the first half of today's show talking with a neurosurgeon who had a life-changing near-death experience. And now we're hearing the story of Annie Kapp. She's the author of Beyond Goodbye, an extraordinary story of a shared death experience, where she wrote about what happened between her and her mother, Betty. It was back in 2004, thousands of miles away from where Annie lives in Canterbury, England, Betty began actively dying in Oregon. Annie, in the middle of a therapy session with a patient, began to cough and choke, and when she got a flash in her mind that she needed to call her mother, well, she was right, too. When Annie's call came through, Betty was coughing, taking her final breaths. Annie's sister put the phone against her mother's head. Annie told her she loved her, and she could go. It would be all right. And right there on the line, Betty died. I asked Annie, what does she make of all this?
Well, for me, you know, I've had a life-threatening illness. The last 2 years I've been fighting cancer. And the thing that is interesting is I had people say to me, are you afraid of dying? You know, if the cancer doesn't go or what have you. And I said, you know, I'm not afraid of dying. That's something my mother changed in me. She gave me this wonderful feeling that we continue and love continues and consciousness and even your personality, I think, continues into the afterlife. And you go on and do other things and choose to do what you want to do, maybe reincarnate or, I don't know, do special things. So I think what she gave me was this gift of certainty that we continue and love goes on. And it is extremely comforting. And if I can give that comfort to you, that's really was my goal in writing my book in the first place, was to comfort people who might be experiencing things and don't know what's happening, or having someone die and not have any feeling like I experienced. I'm just really lucky. I think I'm really lucky. I got exposed to something that was so transformative for me. You know, because if you don't believe in it and then it happens to you, I can't deny it. You know, I can't deny it anymore.
And even me listening to the story, I would have to go through it to truly, truly for myself, believe that there's more.
That it happened. Yeah. Yeah. No, I can understand that too. And I would have been the same way, you know, before it happened to me, I would have thought, lovely Annie, wishful thinking, how nice.
Wouldn't that
for
be
you,
nice?
You know, you little delusional girl, you know, but I had it happen and I'm lucky for that. So. And I think if there was any kind of ulterior motive of my mother, that could have been it, because she knew I didn't have a faith, and that I, at the time, I was scared of dying. I thought you rotted and that worms ate your brains. And I had a very dark, very dark, very sad thinking that when you're dead, the lights get turned off and that's it. And then you sit there in the cold, and yeah, it was terrible. So I think, you know, who knows, maybe she saw what was happening and saw how beautiful it was and went, I'm going to go over and show Annie it's something, you know. I wish I could have seen what she saw. That's the only regret I have, is I would have loved to have seen, you know, the lovely lights, you know.
It sounds like maybe you will.
Yeah, hopefully not soon.
Do you still connect with her?
I do, yeah. I think about her daily. I think she would really love to know that, actually, that she lingers with me so, so well. But I do sometimes in my head speak with her, and I feel like she's responding. So that works for me. And matter of fact, just last week, I was telling you, I was waiting for my scan results, and I was looking up to the sky and I'm saying, Mom, you know, I really love you. And yes, I'd love to come visit, but I'm not ready yet. You just have to wait.
If you could sit down with your mother and have a real conversation with her now, you know, it's been 10 years since your book came out.
17 since she died, yeah.
Yeah. What would you like to say to her?
I think I'd just thank her. You know, I give her the massive, most massive hug I could give her, and just thank her for changing my, you know, I'm not afraid anymore. So that's, what a blessing.
Is there a way that you can sum up? Like, I want to ask, what do you think is happening? Like, what's the arrangement that maybe we who haven't been through this understand? I mean, transmitter, receiver, is your mom everywhere? Are you everywhere? Like, what have you learned, or what do you make of what this says about our consciousness and our consciousness as it goes through the mortality of our own bodies?
That's a big question, but you know, I'm not the scientist doing the research, but what they believe is that the brain acts either as a filter or as a receiver, like a television set, picking up the signal from, you know, from the television waves being sent broadcast. So that the belief is that's what's happening with our brain, and that the consciousness, so who we are, our soul, whatever you want to call it, the who we are is not really within the brain. It's outside the brain. That's just the filter or the receiver, and that the information is everywhere. And that apparently you're what they call non-local. So it's a quantum physics kind of thing where if I'm thinking about you, where you're physically in Connecticut, we're mingling our molecules on a molecular level. Apparently there's actually that we're touching each other in some way, be it a, you know, invisible way. So I do believe that somehow the biggest things we're going to learn in the next 20 to 50 years, maybe even 100 years, is the capacity of what our consciousness can do. Because there are people, you know, there's people that are used with the military and with the police force to find lost people or to do remote viewing and find out, you know, where they are on the war front. And there's all these things that are used that supposedly don't happen, but if people are using those people for you know, commercial gain or for military gain, that they do believe it, they just don't talk about it.
Yeah, if there's a profit off of it, it's got to be working.
Yeah. So I really think, I don't think we know really what we are and what we're capable of. I don't know that we're going to know the question you've asked. I don't know whether in our lifetime whether we'll have that kind of understanding, but I do think we just continue. And I don't know if we continue as long as we want to, and we have choices whether we come back and try another, like almost like an acting thing, like you're in a stage play. But I just think that energy just continues and love continues. So that's all I can say, really, is that it's all pretty profound stuff until you have, I mean, once you have it happen, if you have something happen for you, something, it doesn't have to be somebody dying, by the way, just any kind of spiritually transformative experience. It could be that you're walking amongst the redwood forest, you know, in a trip to California, and you have something happen that just markedly changes you. So it doesn't have to be death. You know, these kind of transformative experiences can be very pleasant things. They don't have to be around grief. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that there's still a lot of I don't know in you. I haven't heard you talk about God or heaven by name, like, or so I appreciate that there is still sort of like, I know more than I did, but there's still plenty I don't know, which is kind of the fun of it, right? I mean, if we did know, then what are we doing here?
Yeah, and if you think, exactly, and some people think too that you create what happens for you after you leave this particular physical plane, that what happens for you is different anyway. So perhaps people follow whatever their belief system is. I don't really have one, so I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I mean, I do believe we continue.
Maybe other planets too.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows?
Other realms we aren't even aware of. Because if you think about it, there have been, you know, over 100 billion souls have been on planet Earth, as far as we draw a line at Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
So where are they now?
Yeah.
Where were they before? There will be more, obviously.
And are they still right next to you? They might still right be here. You know, you just don't know that. You just can't see them.
Leaving you bobby pins.
Yeah, leaving me bobby pins. Maybe it's an alien, not my mother. You never know. Who knows?
I like not knowing, though.
Yeah, no, I'm very open to things, but I do feel there is something good and benevolent. That's the sense I have. There's something benevolent about it all that is all about love. Heaven, I don't know about, but love, yeah.
I can see how that would be easy to feel, even with the trials and tribulations that you've been through and that I've been through. But I also think about like human beings who are suffering in ways that would turn us inside out to imagine, let alone experience.
And how can there be a benevolent being? Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's a white man in a big robe. But I think there's some kind of benevolence out there. Maybe it's this whole thing people talk about, the universe. I haven't got the answers. I just feel better for experiencing what happened with my mom. I'm just not afraid. That's all. I mean, that's the big takeaway for me, is I'm not afraid.
And I'm glad we don't know. I'd rather not know, but I do like seeking it.
Yes.
So thank you. Annie Kapp, thank you so much for talking with me.
I enjoyed it immensely. Thank you.
Audacious is produced by me, Jessica Severin DiMartinez, and Katie Talarski, with help from our interns, Abi Levine and Dylan Reyes, at Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. Subscribe to Audacious and you'll always get to hear the show a day early. And plus, you can listen back to shows featuring stories like how a woman communicated her way out of locked-in syndrome using blinking, what it's like to use a therapy baby to cope with depression and anxiety. You can hear them all at ctpublic.org/audacious or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for leaving that review on Apple Podcasts. That's how the unfeeling podcast machine knows how to favor our show. Send me your reactions and show ideas on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Kyone Wolf. And my email is cwolf@ctpublic.org. Thanks for listening.